From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The political left has turned to sports in recent years for extra ammunition in its ideological battles. You'll hear from two experts who have watched the changes. They'll explain how politics has affected the business of sports. Speaking of politics, a tug of war between the North Carolina governor and General Assembly heads to the state Supreme Court. You'll hear highlights. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions targeted gang violence during a recent trip to Winston-Salem. He discussed the federal government's role in helping local law enforcement agencies fight gangs. And we'll explore President Trump's recent comments blaming online shopping giant Amazon for local economic woes. We'll hear from an economist who says he's wrong. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
A North Carolina woman wants to open a makeup school, but the North Carolina Board of Cosmetic Art Examiners refuses to give her a license. Now, she says she's been told she won't be allowed to operate her cosmetology school legally, but if she were to make it an aesthetics school, that would be okay with the state. Problem is, it's not okay with her for all sorts of reasons, and now she's suing to try to get a decision. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Carolina Journal has been reporting on this story. He's here to talk about that. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you.
First of all, why is the state of North Carolina even interested in a woman from Charlotte who wants to open a makeup school?
The main reason they're interested in this is that they are they're in the position of licensing people who are involved, who are estheticians and who are cosmetologists. And what they want to make sure is that people who are licensed to do one thing don't do something else. And what they're saying is that, in this particular case, the woman from Charlotte, Yasna Bukvich Bayani, who was wanting to open a makeup school, is licensed to do what she's doing, which is as an esthetician, but that to open a makeup school, she's going to have to also be involved in cosmetology, which involves a whole different set of equipment that she would have to buy, unrelated to teaching people how to apply makeup, and also teaching all sorts of additional information about skills that have nothing to do with applying makeup. So it's entirely a regulatory bureaucratic maze that she's in right now.
Okay, so our listeners are probably gathering by now. You are a male. I am a female.
Right.
I am wearing makeup, and I'm trying to figure out exactly what would be the harm to me should this Charlotte woman give me a makeup lesson and I not like the makeup?
That's the question that will be before the court. And that's also the question that's before an awful lot of licensing boards in North Carolina. How does the board's ability to affirm or deny someone's ability to earn a living doing something affect public health and safety? And the question that the woman's doing here with the support of the Institute for Justice in Washington, D.C., is a First Amendment challenge. And this is not a challenge to the occupational licensing regime per se, but this is more arguing that the First Amendment says you have a right to teach people, you have a right to speak, you have a right to tell somebody or to provide advice as any number of sites any number of videos on YouTube or places like Craftsy or different websites like that that provide advice can do without any problems whatsoever. However, if you rent or buy a brick and mortar facility and you offer classes and you have people physically in the building, all of a sudden you've got to jump through all these regulatory barriers that the person who's speaking on YouTube, or as in Yasna's case, has actually gone on television and done makeup demonstrations and things like that. She can do that just fine as long as she's not telling anybody else how to do it.
Pretty fascinating. So the Institute for Justice, they're taking the First Amendment challenge route versus this is just an outrageous way to keep her from earning a living.
Right.
Do they think that they have a greater likelihood to prevail on a First Amendment argument?
I'm guessing that that has to be their strategy there, because they could go with the North Carolina constitutional provision, which says that you have a right to earn a living, basically, that you cannot be denied the fruits of your labor. But this First Amendment approach could have much more far-reaching implications for, you would imagine, for things like culinary schools or things like that, in which it might well be possible for people who are simply wishing to teach something would not be required to go through. And in her case, she would have to she'd have to possibly buy tens of thousands of dollars of equipment to do things like waxing, which she doesn't do. or in this case, as is described, for every hour that she teaches someone how to apply makeup, she would also have to spend an additional 5 hours talking about things like hair removal and how to give facials, which, again, the people who are attending her school would not have any interest in knowing. Or if so, they would just enroll someplace else. So it has to do with her ability to speak freely without being told by the government what she has to say and how she has to say it.
Rick, it also seems to be just such an effort to discourage someone who wants to use her skill to earn a living for herself. And one would think that in a civil society that you want to encourage people to do that, to be
right.
self-sufficient.
That's right. This is definitely a barrier to entrepreneurship and a barrier to people setting their own pace and their own course in life. And again, in this case, what she's trying to do with the school is not train cosmetologists or not train aestheticians. She's simply helping to instruct people how to apply makeup better, or how to help their friends who want, you know, to learn makeup skills. In some cases, her students may well be other licensed aestheticians or cosmetologists even who want to learn this, but she has a certain ability to teach, and she wants to use that, and she wants to be able to do so professionally. And right now, the state of North Carolina says she can't.
Now, the other avenue that that we are traditionally used to hearing about when we hear these challenges is the issue of public safety and public health. We know that in North Carolina, we've got a number of trades and skilled areas where licenses are required. And the discussion really now seems to be about where is that line where public safety or public health really would be impacted if someone was involved in doing something incorrectly. But we've got some things that are licensed in our state that really don't rise to that level, do they?
Landscape architecture is one of them. I don't know if it actually passed the General Assembly, but I know that there was a bill that got through at least one body of the General Assembly that would license music therapists, for instance. And so, I mean, there are all sorts of different areas. Anyone who has a specialized skill and wants to provide training in that skill to others always wants to get some sort of a legal advantage over those who may not have the level of training or certification. And so there's always this battle of making sure that outsiders are not allowed in.
So it's about keeping competition out.
Exactly. It's restraint of trade is what it is largely, which and that's what most occupational licensing is about. There certainly are areas in which public health and safety is a concern. This would not seem to be one of them. And as John Sanders of the John Locke Foundation has said, there are places like websites like Yelp. There are all sorts of different consumer-oriented websites, social media outlets where people can rate whether or not someone's doing a good job or a bad job, especially if it doesn't have any effect on whether or not they're endangering someone's life or endangering someone's health.
And especially if she were to operate and be working with other people who are in that field. I mean, word gets around, frankly, between shops and specialists and things like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
who to recommend and who not to recommend.
I mean, yes. I mean, the network of everything from hairstylists to makeup artists, you name it. I mean, it's a pretty robust amount of communication that goes on. And someone who's doing a job badly, that word gets out pretty quickly.
So in the case of Yasna, what comes next in her lawsuit against the state of North Carolina?
What the attorneys are attempting to do is to get the court to enjoin the state and to say to the state, no, you can't stop her from opening this school. And if they do that, then at that point they may not, the lawsuit may be over. But if the court says, no, we're going to allow this prohibition to maintain itself, then you'll have oral arguments and it will go to a full, eventually to a full trial.
And Carolina Journal will be covering all the developments. This story we've been talking about, written by Lindsay Marcello of Carolina Journal. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Many of us like to play and watch sports for the competition, the entertainment, the chance to marvel at athletic skill. But our next guests have been focusing on a disturbing trend in the sports world. They recently spoke to the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society on the following theme: the left is hijacking the sports industry and making it their weapon. Our guests are Ed Teriakian, Associate Professor of Corporate Finance and Business Economics at Duke University, and John Pritchett, Senior Vice President of the John Locke Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
So this is sort of a disturbing trend. If the left is turning the sports world into a political weapon, tell us how you came to observe this.
Well, I'll start. So Ed and I have similar backgrounds in that we spent a lot of time outside of public policy and education and in the private world, and both of us a lot of that time in the sports industries. Ed even more so than myself, economics and corporate finance, but I spent a lot of time in the sports industry as well as Ed did. And we're also conservatives. So not only in our profession, but just personally in our own views, we've observed what's been going on. And it's been sort of a slow drip. And then suddenly there's been an acceleration of it. And I think most people saw it for the first time. We've been observing it for a while. But with the HB2 incident took place in North Carolina earlier this year and last year. And so we decided, let's get together and let's start adding a little bit of science and data and look at how good this is for businesses, whether it's prudent for people like Disney and ESPN. Let's look at it from a constitutional perspective, whether this is something that the ACC and the NCAA and other sports organizations should be doing. Is it in their mission? And what does all of this mean for the consumer and for those of us who just enjoy sports, regardless of what our political persuasions are?
How is this playing out? So we're talking about the left hijacking the sports industry. How do we see this happening?
I would like to point out I was Christian Leitner's agent, just as an aside.
So okay.
I do have a deep-rooted love of sports. And having been at Duke for a few years, you know, Duke is one of those rare institutions that has both outstanding academics and wonderful sports, and you just began to see some things that were disturbing. From a corporate finance standpoint, which is what I teach, you've watched the worldwide leader in sports quickly become the worldwide leader in political rhetoric.
And this is ESPN
we're talking about. This is ESPN. And it's manifested itself in that they had 100 million viewers just 3 years ago, and now they're down in the low 80s, and they've raised their prices, and they're not making money, and Disney knows this. And the claim that has been bandied about for the last year and a half is it's because they're inserting politics into what we all like to do, which is watch sports. And suddenly, the number of people who are turning off ESPN is at an alarming rate. And for someone like Disney, as a corporate finance professor, it manifests itself in the earnings. This is what we're seeing, and regardless of what Disney's take on it is, it's clear from their earnings that they were the worst performing stock in the Dow Jones last year. You have to start looking more closely at what's going on.
And in the case of ESPN, we're talking about the way the commentators are presenting sports issues, throwing politics into it. But it also plays out in other ways, too, like with these various leagues being involved with trying to weaponize sports. Isn't that right?
Sure. Yeah. You know, ESPN is one of the partners in this sort of left weaponization argument or observation. It takes multiple parties. You have the content providers. You have the sports leagues themselves. You have to have a media partner. You also then, for that to work, to your point, to provide shareholder value and profitability, you got to have corporate support. The one piece that it seems the left has sort of taken for granted is the most essential component of this business model, which is the consumers. Those who enjoy sports and who go to sports as an escape or as a way to find a common denominator of the things, no matter what our political persuasions are, that we enjoy. And so when you start to look closely at the data, which is what's astonishing for people like Ed and I that look at this kind of stuff and have all of our lives, of sports viewers, who are they? What is their likelihood to vote? How do they skew along political or policy lines? And you start to realize that the majority of them are in the center-right, high voter turnout area. And this has been borne out in data for some time. And so it really makes you question, why would you go about doing that if your goal ultimately is to provide shareholder value and your goal ultimately is to run a successful business and to give people what they want so you'll have higher ratings and therefore more corporate support? It makes you scratch your head and realize there's more going on here than just trying to turn a profit.
From that vantage point, it sounds like somewhat shooting yourself in the foot.
It truly is. You know, with ESPN, it's been systematic. You've seen them get rid of some conservative announcers. You've seen their omnibusman, who's there to sort of give you the state of affairs, say, you know, we lean pretty left. The systemic part is when you see, in conjunction with leagues, with the NCAA, with the ACC, that's the worrisome part here, because they control the content. They're the ones who have the product. ESPN is sort of a bystander that buys the product and sells it to us. But when you see both systematic and systemic, it's very hard for a sports viewer to escape it. And that's what's alarming to us.
You mentioned that you are seeing this in terms of the bottom line for ESPN, and I would imagine this would also have an impact on other sports networks or leagues that engage in this if they're making their own customers mad. Is that going to be what ultimately corrects this, or is there going to be a correction? I mean, did the folks who are looking at these numbers seem to see that there is a problem, or can we tell that they do or not?
So ESPN is the example that I point to say they just don't seem to care until just in the last quarter, when you sort of hit epic proportions of subscriber loss. 10,000 a day is what they're averaging now. And when you've lost $2 billion in top-line revenue, when your valuation for ESPN goes from $50 billion 3 years ago to $5 billion today, I'm from that old school that says $1 billion is still a lot of money. So 45 of them, that's a whole lot of money. And if you're Bob Iger, the CEO, chairman of Disney, regardless of your political persuasion, he's a big Hillary fan, you have a valuation for your shareholders that says, hey, wait a minute, we have to start looking. So just recently, they have announced a major restructuring at the management level. Looks like the CEO is going to be stepping down shortly. Yes, in other words, they do have to look at it.
I think where you also start to see some pushback is, let's take a look at this whole sort of sports complex. So if you follow the NCAA like I have, or the ACC, and if you look at all of the ways they will be affected by the problems at ESPN and Disney. Most of the valuations, this goes to the pro sports level as well, but if we just look at the lens of college athletics, the number of employees, the salaries, the executives at the NCAA level, the Taj Mahals that are being built for athletic directors and their gigantic staffs that have grown exponentially, all of these sort of things will start to then suddenly be a question mark. We may not have perpetual growth because most of that growth has been driven by media rights.
Well, two people who are going to be watching very closely as these factors play out are Ed Teriakian, who is Associate Professor of Corporate Finance and Business Economics at Duke University, and you just heard him there, John Pritchett, Senior Vice President of the John Locke Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thanks, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue. More visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read. A new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. Now, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal. We hold government accountable to you.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's Democratic governor and Republican-led General Assembly continue to wage a political battle in the courts. The state Supreme Court recently heard opposing views about a law that would transform the state board of elections. It would become an 8-member group with an equal number of Democrats and Republicans. Governor Roy Cooper objects. His attorney, Jim Phillips, explains why.
Early voting is a perfect example. That law leaves substantial discretion to the executive in how it will be carried out. The general statute calls for early voting, says it will happen, and then calls for a minimum number of locations and a minimum number of days, 17 days, the county board of elections headquarters. That's the default. But it authorizes the executive to expand that. Upon approval of both the local county board and the state board, the executive can expand the number of days for early voting, including more Saturdays, and the number of locations. The executive, by implementing its policy views, can make it easier to vote. And that reinforces the McCrory Court's insistence that the governor be able to appoint people who share his views and priorities to boards that have final executive authority. The governor has to be able to appoint a majority of people to boards who share his views and priorities when those boards have final executive authority.
Attorney Noah Huffstetler represents the General Assembly. He offered the court an opposing view.
Under our Constitution, the General Assembly has all powers, not specifically reserved to a different branch of state government. The power that inheres to the people of North Carolina is exercised through its representatives in the General Assembly. But what Article 3, Section 5, Subdivision 10 does do, it's a textual recognition of the General Assembly's power to organize and reorganize departments of state government. And it gives the governor a limited and circumscribed role to play in that reorganization. He may essentially suggest to the General Assembly changes through timely submission of executive orders, which the General Assembly can then accept, reject, or modify. But it makes very clear that it is the General Assembly that has the final decision-making role in this area.
With the governor on one side and the legislature on the other, the final decision about the future of North Carolina's Elections Board rests with the courts. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. The nation's top law enforcement officer gave a recent pep talk in North Carolina. It focused on police and sheriff's officers who target gang violence in the Tar Heel State. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions addressed the North Carolina Gang Investigators Association meeting in Winston-Salem.
We're all in this together, and we all face the threat of violent gangs. It's a serious national problem. It is a priority. Gang attacking gangs is a priority of the U.S. Department of Justice, and we're going to support you in your efforts. This is not just a big city problem. I heard recently about Hamlet, North Carolina, where this year's annual Independence Day celebration was canceled suddenly because of threats of gang violence. This is a town of about 7,000 people, bigger than where I grew up. And I certainly would respect the decision of the city leaders, but it is infuriating, isn't it, and wrong that they had to make such a decision. This is America. We will not be held hostage in our homes and our communities by gangsters. It cannot be.
Why does the U.S. Attorney General believe it's important to fight gangs?
Gangs seek to profit off the victimization of others through drug trafficking, extortion, murdering rivals, robbing innocent bystanders, trafficking vulnerable juveniles for sex. They are outlaws. They're outside the decent system of America.
Sessions admitted he was preaching to the choir when addressing professional gang investigators.
You've been in crime scenes. You've seen the aftermath of gang warfare and drug crimes. You know what is at stake. And you also know that this threat has been growing. According to the FBI's most recent national gang report, approximately half of the gang investigators they surveyed said that gang membership and gang activity are increasing. I'm sure many of them felt there was a level, and even fewer believe it's decreasing. Approximately one-third of jurisdictions reported an increase in threats to law enforcement. So in recent years, North Carolina has been one of the many parts of the country that has experienced violent crime and homicide increases. Nationally, the murder rate has surged by nearly 11% in just 1 year. 11% in 1 year, the biggest increase since 1968. The homicide rate is up in 27 of our 35 largest cities, some dramatically. And I don't think this is a blip. In my best judgment, from my time in law enforcement and watching it from the Senate Judiciary Committee, I'm afraid this is a trend, the starting of a trend that we do not want to see happen.
That's U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking recently in Winston-Salem. He addressed the North Carolina Gang Investigators Association.
As the gang threat has grown, so have our efforts to fight back. The Department of Justice is using every lawful resource we have, but our best resource really are you, state and local people who are out there every day. And we need you. Gangs are more effective than other criminals because they work together. We're a lot more effective when we work together, too. And we are working together. I feel real good about that, and we want to see it get even better.
Sessions celebrated recent North Carolina success stories.
In April, two Bloods gang members in Charlotte were sentenced for executing two witnesses in a robbery case. Thanks to the FBI, the Charlotte Police, the York County Sheriff's Office, and our assistant United States attorneys, these dangerous murderers will now spend the rest of their lives behind bars, where they can no longer inflict carnage in our communities. And I think it's important to send a message that if you threaten, injure, or kill our witnesses, we are coming after you. We will not accept drug gangs and criminals attacking, killing our witnesses. That's always been an important principle in law enforcement. Well, in 1 month after that, more than 600 law enforcement officers came together to arrest more than 70 alleged members of the Bloods. Together, these defendants have been in charge with a whole host of crimes, including murder, attempted murder, narcotics trafficking, weapons charges, bank fraud, and wire fraud. These charges are the next step in neutralizing the threat posed by the Bloods to North Carolina. We must keep after them. We cannot let them recover from these attacks. And I hope that you will be able to expand the pressure you put on these gang members. Whether it's MS-13, the Bloods, or outlaw motorcycle clubs, gangs are targeting our youth and law-abiding citizens. But I have news for them. We are targeting you.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions shared more information about the federal fight against criminal gangs.
Since the beginning of this year, the Department of Justice has secured more than 1,200 convictions against gang members. Our fight against MS-13 is emblematic, almost a symbol of the effort that we're undergoing. With more than 40,000 members worldwide, including 10,000 in the United States, MS-13 threatens the lives and well-being of every American. MS-13 members brutally rape, rob, extort, and murder. MS-13 has executed and permanently disfigured bystanders to crimes. They have attacked innocent people with chains and bats and machetes. They destroy the lives of innocent middle schoolers that they recruit for membership. The young girls they entrap, gang rape, and sell for sex, and drug addicts they exploit for profits. Guided by their motto, kill, rape, and control, they leave misery, devastation, and death in their wake. But at the United States Department of Justice, we have a motto, too: justice for victims, consequences for criminals. This is our motto. It's our mission. It's your mission. Even though MS-13 is based in El Salvador, its tentacles reach across Central America, Europe, and through 40 U.S. states to within yards of the U.S. Capitol. I wish I could say that North Carolina had not been affected by MS-13, but they're here, and the threat is serious.
Sessions says the nationwide fight against criminal gangs continues.
We will refuse to cede one block, one street corner, one inch to these gangs. They must never be able to assert sovereignty over United States territory. Remember, it's more than just cases. We're looking to reduce crime, to take the bloom off the rose of these gangs, to send a message to young people that you join a gang member, you're going to jail. You're not living the high life. This is not the thing you want to be involved in.
That's U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking recently in Winston-Salem. He addressed the North Carolina Gang Investigators Association. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. If you've ever ordered something online, you have probably ordered something from Amazon. But as Amazon grows, some people are concerned about the negative impact it will have on bricks and mortar stores. President Donald Trump is among that group, tweeting that Amazon is doing damage and jobs are being lost and more. Dr. Roy Cordato, who is the John Locke Foundation's senior economist, saw that tweet and he takes issue with it. He's here to explain why. Roy, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back.
So let me read the full tweet from president. He tweeted, "Amazon is doing great damage to taxpaying retailers. Towns, cities, and states throughout the U.S. are being hurt. Many jobs being lost!" Exclamation mark. President Trump.
Yeah. Well, the fact is that Amazon has no power to do any such thing. And that's because, unlike the government, the institution that President Trump runs, Amazon has no power to force consumers to do anything. In fact, all the power is in the hands of consumers. So when President Trump makes that complaint, he is really complaining about the choices of consumers, because they put Amazon in the position it's in. They choose offers made by Amazon over offers made by Best Buy, Macy's, Belk's, whatever the company is. So I think he displays kind of an ignorance of who's in the driver's seat when it comes to markets, and that's customers.
Now, he also says in that tweet, many jobs being lost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could actually be accurate if one company is doing better over another.
It happens all the time, but I would argue they're not being lost. A lot of them are being shifted to Amazon, right? I mean, the business is going somewhere. The production is actually expanding because Amazon makes products more available and allows people to purchase more stuff than they otherwise would. That means more stuff is being produced, which is, so jobs are probably being shifted, some of them to Amazon itself, and some of them to other retailers or actually producers. So I would argue that they aren't being lost. It's very myopic to say that jobs are being lost. And the fact is that Amazon, even if they were, again, would not have the power to make those jobs in other businesses go away. It's the consumer's decision to stop doing business with, let's say, some brick and mortar businesses and buy through Amazon over the internet. It's their choice, and they could always choose to go back. And if Amazon doesn't watch out, they might. I mean, in other words, a business to maintain that high market share has to really continue to do what they did to gain it. Because, as I say in the piece, we consumers are fickle, right? If some business if some company we're doing business with starts to treat us poorly, we immediately start to look for somebody else. And Amazon is not immune from that.
And to that point, it's interesting because there are some folks who've been writing about Amazon, and as it grows and grows, and at this point now, Whole Foods, it looks like Amazon is going
right.
to be buying Whole Foods. Some people are saying, well, gee, Amazon is going to take over the world, and that means they're heading towards being this mega operation around the world, and therefore it's going to be somehow bad for consumers.
Let's remember, they said that about IBM and the personal computer. They said that about Walmart. And who's putting Walmart out of business now? Amazon, right? I mean, so who's their big competitor? So that's been said a million times. It was said about Zenith and televisions back in the 1950s. That is such a common story, and it's this idea, it's called predatory pricing in economics literature. It's this idea that a company can grow so big, he can get, close to 100% of the market, and then what will he do? He will act like a big monopolist, and what does that mean? Raise prices, treat consumers badly. But the fact is that in order for that business to maintain that market share, he has to do whatever he did to gain it. If he starts treating consumers badly, it doesn't have to come from some business already in the market. There's entrepreneurs out there everywhere waiting to earn a buck to get my business. It's like treating consumers badly is like flashing a sign saying, hey, entrepreneurs, there's profit opportunities right here. And that's what they would be doing. So it's kind of silly. Look, the fact is that only government can do that. Government can grow so big because, and oppress its constituents, if you want to call them that, because they have the power of force. But Amazon has no power to force its customers to purchase their product, and their customers, like myself, I'm an Amazon customer, will turn on them in a heartbeat if they start treating them poorly.
And to your point about coercion and force, the Affordable Care Act.
Oh,
you
sure.
You must have government-approved health insurance or pay a penalty.
That is a very good example.
The interesting thing about President Trump, Roy, is that he is a successful entrepreneur, mm-hmm. a businessman. He has had the heights of success. He's had the depths of failure, and
yes.
he has managed to come back, and now he's been elected president of the United States. Yet he tweeted this, and as you said, it shows kind of a myopic view of the economy. Certainly, he must know that tweet really doesn't square with economics.
Well, I would think that that's the case. I would hope that that's the case. But look, he's a businessman who, let's just be frank, consumers have turned on him more than once, right? So my guess is he really does not – he'd like to protect businesses from consumers and their choices. He's shown that in international trade. I mean, he really – the trade problems he refers to, again, are the result of consumer choices, not the result of anything that some foreign business has done. What they've done is they've attracted consumers by making people – better offers than they can get elsewhere. And to a businessman, that's pretty darn threatening.
Now, Roy, one thing that we are anticipating seeing coming out of the Trump administration is some sort of a detailed tax reform or tax cut plan. We've heard the president talk about this. If you were advising President Trump, what would you advise him to do with the federal tax rate and in the federal tax code?
Well, I think he got off to a good start when he presented his own plan here, however many months ago it was now. I would say take that plan and push it, which is lower rates, dramatically lower corporate rates, I think 15%.
So you essentially like what he has proposed.
Yeah, and I argue at the time it's really learned something from North Carolina. I mean, it's the kind of things that we did in 2013 and then continued to do since then, lowering rates, lowering the corporate income tax rate. So I think his unlike with Amazon and in this other area, I think his instincts are correct.
And in fact, you wrote a piece about that. That is available at johnlock.org, as is the piece we've been talking about with the president's tweet about Amazon. They're both written by Roy Cordato. In this case, the headline, President Attacks Consumers with Amazon Tweet. Roy Cordato is senior economist for the Locke Foundation, a frequent guest here on Carolina Journal Radio. Roy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.